From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Biden administration calls for more oil production abroad as prices rise. Plus, 2 weeks after New York's primary election, Eric Adams is declared the winner and the probable next mayor. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. The U.S. benchmark for oil prices hit a six-year high on Tuesday, nearly $77 a barrel, and the average price of a gallon of gas nationwide is now up to $3.13. This is a political problem for President Biden, and part of what's behind the increase is this cartel of oil exporting countries that's referred to as OPEC Plus, which includes Saudi Arabia and Russia, and which has failed to agree on raising its oil output. And Kim, that has prompted a fascinating statement from an unnamed White House spokesperson who said this, quote, "We are not a party to these talks, but administration officials have been engaged with relevant capitals to urge a compromise solution that will allow proposed production increases to move forward," unquote. So, Kim, what do you make of that as the Biden administration is pulling back from oil and gas production here in the U.S.? It's saying we need more output abroad.
This is crazy. It's a total contradiction. Look, if you look back at the United States, we have put ourselves over the past decade in an enviable position. If you go back prior to 2009, for decades, we were vulnerable to OPEC decisions and to price shocks. You know, look at the 1973 Arab oil embargo because we didn't produce a lot of oil and natural gas here. All of that changed with the fracking revolution. We have doubled in 10 years our crude production. Our gas production by 2019 was up by two-thirds. We were actually exporting certain types of fossil fuels for the first time in decades. We were a net exporter of oil. And we had finally reached something close to that thing that all of these presidents for years had talked about, energy independence. And now Biden is cracking down on all of that here, ending new leases on federal lands, stopping drilling in Anwar, using endangered species rules to cut back on our production while essentially begging other countries to increase theirs. Now, if your overall goal is somehow reducing fossil fuel use, none of this makes any intellectual sense. All you're doing is harming U.S. economic interests, even as people continue to pump oil elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, Kim. The question is, why not U.S. production? I mean, whatever the White House's broader and long-term environmental goals, its climate goals, it is now saying, or at least this unnamed spokesman is saying, that in the short term, we need more oil coming into the market. And so, Bill, I mean, what is the thought process there? First, it would be good for the economy to do it in the U.S., employment, union jobs. And the second thing I would raise is, does anybody think that oil producers in Russia are held to as high of environmental standards as American drillers? The obvious answer to my mind is no. So isn't it better here, Bill, to do the drilling in the U.S. if it has to be done?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that drillers in Russia, for example, don't have to follow the same standards. Look, the basic dilemma is supply and demand. The world is demanding energy. And coming off the COVID-19 crisis, you know, more things are coming back online. And there's a demand and the supply is not growing fast enough with the demand. President Biden came into office vowing to wean the United States off of fossil fuels. He's taken some steps, closing the Keystone pipeline. A lot of those don't have immediate effects, but they'll have long-term effects. They also send signals to producers. So in the U.S., we're not doing anything for supply. You're saying the president recognizes in the short term we need this. The primary need is political. Because what he's recognizing is that people are going to blame him for higher gas prices unless the Saudis and OPEC come through by increasing the supply and therefore lowering the price a little. So I think this is all very cynical and done for political reasons. He appeases the Greens in the U.S. you know, by his actions against fossil fuels. And then he wants OPEC to bail him out, let them do the drilling, send the thing over here. He could still claim victory, and he won't have to pay the natural price of squeezing supply, which is higher prices.
Yeah, I mean, what about the politics here? I mean, I think comparisons to the 70s, the 1970s can be overdrawn. But Kim, I mean, you're right. I think that one promise of the fracking revolution was increased energy independence. You can free foreign policy execution from domestic political concerns about the price of oil. And now the Biden administration seems ready to give that up. And it looks to me like it's beseeching OPEC now, essentially, not to destroy Biden's approval ratings.
Yes, we've talked about the contradiction. We've also talked about the obvious benefit of producing this in the United States in terms of our own economy. You talked about the environmental benefit, having more control over it. There's also, as you just mentioned, the geopolitical element of this. One of the brilliant aspects of actually reaching a form of energy independence over the past decade is that we are no longer held hostage to bad actors that are key parts of OPEC or that foreign oil cartel. You know, for years, we had to tiptoe around our demands with Iran because we were worried that there might be a backlash from OPEC. We have had very difficult relationships with Venezuela over the years. We've been able to free ourselves from that. More recently, for instance, having the ability to export liquid natural gas to our allies in Europe, which has taken pressure off them to feel that they have to cater to Russia. These are all huge benefits of this. And so he's also sacrificing that. And yes, all for his own personal political benefit. If you look at the recent infrastructure negotiations, one of the things that really came out is that the Biden administration is terrified of higher gas prices. They know how bad pocketbook issues can be for administration and approval ratings. And so in the process of those negotiations, for instance, they had a red line. They said, no higher gas taxes to pay for this. No, we don't even want electric vehicle mileage taxes. Nothing that looks like a user fee on Americans, because they know that already gas prices are going up. Utility bills are also going up as the price of natural gas and propane go up. So they're essentially asking some of America's foreign adversaries to step in and make political domestic politics easier for them here on the home front.
And what I would add to that story about voters not liking high energy prices are the rejections of the carbon tax that have taken place over the years. So in Washington state, a pretty blue state, there was a 2016 ballot measure that would have had a carbon tax, and it would have lowered the sales tax to compensate. So essentially, it would be an even wash for voters, and it still failed. It was 59% to 41%. Then there was another measure that got on the ballot, a second ballot initiative, and this time the carbon tax money would have gone to promote clean energy and address climate impacts. That one failed 57% to 43%. And then this year, finally, the legislature there in Washington passed some sort of carbon pricing bill. But my understanding is that it won't kick in till 2023. And it's not clear to me that there won't be a voter backlash when that arrives. And so, Bill, I mean, Biden administration here is caught between these two elements. There's a progressive wing of the party that really just wants to keep the oil in the ground. But the Biden administration seems to recognize that the broader public, mainstream voters who put the president in office, they are not of that view.
Yeah, that's because right now we're tasting the first consequences. For the first 6 months of this year, the Biden administration has acted like as though its climate agenda, which is pretty radical, and its infrastructure bill, which in fact really is a climate agenda, is not going to have costs. It's going to result in great new bridges, great new alternative sources of energy, green, well-paying union jobs. It's going to probably rain iPhones from the sky. Everything was going to be unicorns and rainbows. And now we're finding out people are feeling the pinch from gas prices, that supply and demand really do matter. And they're worried about it. I mean, one of the problems he has from the progressive wing is they don't care what the pain is. They don't care if the price of a gallon of gas goes up to, you know, $6 a gallon. In a way, they would welcome it because it would mean less driving. They want everyone, you know, to ride their bikes to work and so forth. And it's very, very unrealistic. And this is the first instance where the actual real world consequences of what President Joe Biden is trying to push through Congress is hitting people. And they're worried, and they should be worried, because it's something, it moves beyond the theoretical to what you're paying at the gas pump. You know, the in Manhattan, it's easy to overlook gas prices, you know, in a lot of our urban centers, who cares? But, you know, if you're some suburban parent, mom or dad, driving your kids all over the place, picking them up from school, it really hits hard in the pocketbook.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One last thought on the oil markets and the Biden administration's approach to energy. There was also some recent news that the company that was developing the Keystone XL pipeline that has now been canceled because the Biden administration revoked the permits that it needed is now moving to sue. And here's the statement. TC Energy will be seeking to recover more than $15 billion in damages that it has suffered as a result of the U.S. government's breach of its NAFTA obligations, unquote. So, Kim, it's also possible. I don't know what the odds of the success of the suit are, but it's also possible that there will be a very real monetary price tag for the President Biden's move on the Keystone pipeline there.
Correct. And that's on top of everything else. So not only has he annoyed one of our closest allies, Canada to the north, and there were a lot of politicians up there that were furious over this decision. Not only is it adding to the inflationary pressures here in the United States in terms of energy prices, and that's not necessarily as direct a link as some Republicans draw. They say, oh, look, gas prices are higher. That's because of Keystone. They're not tightly related that way. But what it has done, it means that resources from Canada's shale fields have to come by rail now. That's more costly. It causes bottlenecks. And that adds to inflationary prices across the range of goods. But now there's a possibility that taxpayers are going to be on the hook for the fecklessness of the Biden administration, its political agenda. I was waiting for this lawsuit to come because it was an obvious thing. The permits have been issued and billions of dollars of capital have been invested. And this company is rightly feeling as though there is a breach, as it were, of agreement or contract and obligation. So again, I am not entirely sure how that lawsuit will play out. I'm not a lawyer, but this, if it is successful, I would also note that this is just one pipeline that the administration has arbitrarily used regulatory or administrative fiat decision to just stop. And there could be other companies that file similar lawsuits that will cost American taxpayers to get more.
Finally, after many vote counting mishaps, some of which we've discussed here on the podcast, New York's Democratic primary finally has an announced winner. It's Eric Adams, former NYPD cop. Here's part of what he said in his statement. He said, "I've said it before and I'll say it again. This wasn't simply a campaign. It was a five-borough movement of working class New Yorkers coming together for a safer, stronger, healthier city," unquote. Bill, as we're talking about the pinch that Biden is in between the left wing of his party and the moderates who put him in office, here's another candidate, not the left wing's choice, who has squeaked through and won a primary victory. It looks like he'll probably be the next mayor of New York. What do you think that says, Bill, about Democratic politics moving forward?
Well, I think it's a warning shot. Look, if I'm not a Manhattan voter. If I were, I'd vote for Eric Adams. To me, the jury's still a little out. His past is not quite as what his present claims to be in, on crime and other issues. But I think he was the best choice of the candidates. And look, it's very clear he was the only choice making crime and law and order an issue. And none of the other ones were. And I think it shows you what a heavily Democratic city in New York, I believe Democratic registered voters outnumber Republicans 7-1. And it shows this is what, you know, this is what they wanted. So I think it's a good sign that Eric Adams prevailed. And I hope Democrats in other major cities take the message.
Well, some seem to. I mean, it's been interesting, Kim, to watch the White House changing its message here. Recently, it has been trying to argue that Republicans are really the ones who are trying to defund the police. What is the story behind that talking point, and what do you make of it?
It's wild on its face. It's also wild when you really delve down into it. So what's clearly happening here is the Biden White House is, along with gas prices, some of the things we're talking about, another one of those issues that really tend to frustrate and go home to voters are safety and crime in their neighborhoods. And a lot of people began warning about this last year as we were having rioting and looting and all of the problems. Now this has really become an inescapable story with rising gun violence and crime in major cities across the country. After the defund the police movement, the White House is feeling heat on this, and suddenly it comes out that with this bizarre talking point that somehow this is Republicans' fault. And to get to that point, you have to, their argument is, if you look at the COVID relief money that they sent out, that, and in particular, the portion of it that was meant to just be straight out dollars to federal and state governments, because some of those state and local governments have used that money to shore up their police departments, and because Republicans voted against that bill, they therefore are somehow defunding the police. It's crazy, because first of all, the White House never pitched this money as going to law enforcement. It was just that, you know, we need to bail out the states because they've had a tough time because of COVID. It's also not clear how much of it has even gone to that purpose. But no matter how you look at it, this is money that's going to make up for gaps for things that Democrats demanded, Democrat cuts to law enforcement. No Republican is on record that I know of for defunding the police. So this sort of just shows the desperation and is a little indicator about how worried they are about the crime story going into the next election.
And another political actor who seems to be moving in the same direction is New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. On Tuesday, he announced what he's describing as a first in the nation gun violence disaster emergency. And this statement from the governor says that it will treat gun violence as a public health crisis. It will create an Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And Bill, I mean, we can talk about what is in here and whether it seems likely to be effective or not. But it is also interesting, just as a political story, that Governor Cuomo, who knows how to get elected to office, really seems to be seeing the salience of the crime as an issue here going into the next election.
Yeah, it's complete nonsense. You know, whenever I hear the term gun violence, when people use gun violence, they use that rather than saying violent crime. And it sounds to me like a bunch of guns meeting together and deciding we're going to go out on our own and commit violence. You know, it's people that commit the violence. And what we're seeing in New York with the explosion of gun violence isn't a coincidence. It's the result of many factors, including the bail reform that's letting repeat offenders back on the streets. And it's the cutting back of different police units, the anti-crime unit in New York City. We really had cut down on gun violence quite considerably over the years, starting with Rudy Giuliani and continuing through Mike Bloomberg. Why has it changed now? It's because Bill de Blasio and these other people they say the enemy is guns rather than bad guys using guns. Look, the greatest program for getting illegal guns off the street was stop and frisk. You know, stop and frisk is what I think of as gun control for bad guys. If you put a gun in your pants pocket or in the waistband of your pants and you hopped a turnstile and a cop caught you, he would catch the gun. And they took lots of guns there. But, you know, the liberals just want to pretend it's the guns themselves, and they treat the gun that's sitting in someone's house bothering no one the same as they do a guy going out on the street with it. So we know it's not going to do anything for guns. We know what works because we did it before. And there's been a deliberate plan by Democrats, especially Bill de Blasio, to walk away from that and to try to discredit it. I mean, to my great sorrow, even Mike Bloomberg, when he ran for the Democratic Party nomination, had to disavow much of his great treatment, which saved an awful lot of Black and Latino lives.
A final couple thoughts on the New York mayoral race. One is relating to the election being the first ranked choice election in the city's recent city history. So voters on the ballot could rank their top candidates from 1 to 5, and some interesting swings there. So we always hear, Kim, about how ranked choice voting advocates say most of the time the person who gets first, the candidate who gets first in the first round, as other candidates are eliminated, will still prevail and will become a consensus candidate. And the first thing to notice here about New York is that came close to not happening. So in the first round of the voting, the winner, Eric Adams, had 31% essentially, and the third place candidate, Catherine Garcia, had about 20%. And it's interesting, as the other candidates were eliminated, including the person who came in second in the first tabulation, Catherine Garcia kept climbing and came within 1% of overtaking Eric Adams. That's only about 8,500 votes. And so, Kim, I mean, that would have been an earthquake. The person who came in third in the first tabulation ends up winning the race. It's hard to see how that would have increased the comedy of New York elections.
Right. And I think that if you are a ranked choice voter advocate, you are fortunate that this is how it turned out, because if there had been that kind of an upset, it really would have cut against a lot of their arguments that this is just supposed to make things more efficient and sort of be a more fair way to run elections. Because as you have noted, we have noted on this podcast, one of the problems with this system is that you end up with these invalidated votes. If you have a normal, if you have a regular runoff type system, and your guy doesn't make it into the top two, you have a chance again to vote. Under this system, if neither of your people is there, you just get eliminated, and you no longer have had any say really in the final winner of the election. So there's a whole lot of problems with this. They've really been exposed in New York. The ranked choice voter groups are going to try very hard. They already are, to say, oh, no, nothing to see here. No problem. It was very efficient. People understood it. But I think it's been a big red warning sign to everyone else about the wisdom and merits of this. And we'll see where that movement goes from here as a result.
Yeah, that was my last thought, just an update on the numbers of these inactive ballots. So as a reminder, Eric Adams won in the final tally by about 8,500 votes. But if you looked at the ranked choice system, there are about 140,000 votes with no choices left, is what the City Board of Elections website says. So those are votes for candidates who have been eliminated, and they did not rank either Eric Adams or the runner-up. And so it's interesting, because it's reported as Eric Adams wins 51% to 49%. But if you include all those ballots that are now inactive, it's really about 43% to 42%, with 15% of the ballots sitting on the side. And we also, I would add, I would be curious to see the number of ballots that were rejected because they were filled out incorrectly. And also the number of ballots who, you know, you have a chance to rank five candidates, the number of ballots that only have one candidate chosen. I'd be curious to see those numbers. But Bill, I agree with Kim here that it will be interesting to see how the ranked choice advocates fare after this and whether there's some increased opposition when people see how it played out in New York.
Yeah, well, I think that because Eric Adams won, and I think he was, you know, the favorite for number one, it doesn't raise as many questions as it might if Catherine Garcia had won. You know, she started out in third, I think, and catapulted to second because of the secondary choices. As you mentioned, there were 139,000 ballots that they called exhausted ballots, meaning that at the end, they didn't count because the second, third, fourth, and fifth choices weren't still running. So, you know, they had their shot in the first round, but not in the others. Remember, the whole purpose of the ranked choice was to eliminate the need for a runoff. So it will be interesting to see. I mean, the other problem with the ranked choice system is that it chose New York City, and the Board of Elections just has a terrible track record in handling things, much less something of this complexity. So it will be interesting to see if this is considered a success or it's considered half a success. It seems to me a very muddied outcome. I'm not sure most people, including most voters, really understand how it worked.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.